All right. This is Tiffany Schrader. It's 6-6-2012. I'm here with Bob Carr and Roger Groenwald. Correct? Mm-hmm. And we are researching Wisconsin, or queer Wisconsin, in Eau Claire. I think what you gave me a brief history about, just like a synopsis of, you know, where you guys come from and stuff. And I think one thing that's really intriguing to us is your involvement, how long you've been here primarily in Eau Claire, and your involvement in the school systems. So, I'm just gonna, begin by, could either of you paint me a picture of Eau Claire just, throughout time as you guys have grown here?
Give me a cue.
Well, we moved here in the 70s.
We were college students. I was. Well, you were a graduate student, and I transferred here. We had met a year earlier or something and had lived for a summer in La Crosse, and he had gotten a fellowship at Stout. And so I transferred to Eau Claire, and we lived in Menominee for a year and then moved here. And in those days, things were really secretive, so there really wasn't much of a large known community. And of course, I was in theater, believe it or not, even then that was secretive. But slowly, in about a year, we had met some friends that we socialized with, gay friends. But then, as now, we aren't exclusively gay or heterosexually oriented. Most of our friends are just friends. We never chose our friends on their you know, sexuality. We choose our friends on who they are, you know, personality wise. So I would say at this time the majority of our friends are heterosexual as opposed to homosexual, mm-hmm. just because of our age. You know, they've moved away and they've died, and you know, we don't go to bars or anything. So our opportunity to meet other couples our age, you know, is pretty difficult. So the majority of our friends are
back in the 70s when we first moved here. I got a job bartending at the only gay bar in town, and it wasn't totally gay bar. It was just a mixed bar and very secretive. And that's how we met a lot of people, both gay and straight, because mm-hmm. they were, you know, we'd go down to the bars and hang out like anybody does in their youth. And I was there for probably about a year. Yeah, I think about a year. And then I started working at the Hotel Eau Claire, which was a big hotel in downtown Eau Claire. And that was not a gay bar, but it was, you know, there were a lot of people who came from the other bar there just because it was comfortable. So that was the only socialization at that time, probably, was either with our friends or through the bar scene. And there wasn't a lot of, there were no gay activities, you know, that were called that.
So you said you came here in 1972, was that?
Yeah, no, not 72.
No, well, oh. We came here in the 60s, yeah. Oh, yeah. I started working, yeah, I'm sorry, we came here in the 60s. We came here in I started graduate school at Stout in 1966. That's when you also started here at the university.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And where did you guys grow up?
I grew up in Wabasha, Minnesota.
Yeah, I grew up in southwest Minnesota near Worthington, and went to Winona State, and that's where I first met Bob. I was a
big man on campus.
I was
he's a politician. No. Collegiate club, fraternity. No. You were.
But I was in Student Senate, and we had a homecoming show, and he auditioned with his black dummy as a ventriloquist. Remember that? I didn't really know him then, but that's why we first met very briefly, and then years later we met again after I was out of school and teaching for 2 years.
When did, I'll start with you, Bob. Bob, when did you come out to the community, or when was your coming out experience?
It, of course, was so terribly dramatic, but I was 22 at the time.
Okay. Would you like to elaborate on the experience?
Well, I had always felt that, but, you know, there were no role models or no TV, and whenever you read or heard in literature about anyone who was gay, it was very bad, and they always had a dramatic and terrible end, and people just didn't talk about it. So, you know, I had nothing to identify with. I thought I was the only one in the world, and I thought I was, You know, I converted to Catholicism because Catholicism, you know, preaches miracles. And so I prayed, and nothing happened. And so one night I was going to another state, but I also had a scholarship at St. Teresa's, which was a woman's finishing school. But I had a scholarship in theater, and part of the duties was to work events. And the Chicago Chamber Orchestra came to town, and I was working backstage, and there was this French horn player, and the rest is history. I thought, my God, it was like a bad movie. The bells were ringing, the clouds were opening, the sun was shining through, and then my straight roommate walked in on us.
Oh.
Well, being an actor for us, I pretended I had been attacked well after the kid left, and played that for as long as I could. But I was 22.
Mm-hmm. And that was in Minnesota.
That was in Winona. Yeah.
And did you come out to your family?
No, after that? My family came out to me.
Okay. And what was that experience like?
First of all, you can only have a roommate so long. And so after 10 years or so, my mother would drop little things like, well, if you do get divorced, I want that. And I found out later, I was so irritated that my brothers were trying to line me up with people. Mm-hmm. And I was so naive, I didn't know what was going on. And they were trying, often when I was a kid, when I was still in high school and a couple years thereafter. And it finally came to the forefront, 10 or 15 years later, when that creepy man from Wabasha was hounding me all the time from my hometown. And in those days, we had to worry about the draft in Vietnam. And I tried to be excused from that through a variety of ways, for a variety of reasons. Not because I was gay, because I just didn't believe in war and I didn't want to do it. And you could go and you could, what we call, check the box on your, whatever those cards were, when you had to go in for physical. And the box meant you were gay. And you had to go up there to the... What do you call those places?
Selective service.
Selective service place with all these people and see people and pronounce what you were publicly, and then you had to walk around.
Was me.
Well, we all did, with your folder with, what did they put on it?
Mine said sexual deviant.
Yeah, deviant.
In big black letters.
Yeah, and wherever you went, you had deviant on this envelope you're carrying. And but a person of the draft board in my hometown, a few years later when I went home, made advances, and I didn't want anything of it, but he kept calling me, and finally my brother called. He said, is so and so bothering you? And I said, well, yeah, really. Is it because you're gay? Is he doing it because you're gay? And I said, yeah. And you and Donnie took care of it, and that never happened. But that's basically how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Then over the, I mean, they knew long before I did. And we were very, very close. My family are not necessarily close people. We love each other. We just don't keep in touch. But my sisters-in-law are very close people. And once my brothers married them, they decided we were going to be a family. And so they made sure that we had social contact all the time. And, we're just very close with them. And I adore their children. And the daughters are wonderful. And I said to them, we have so much in common. You like pizza. I like pizza. You like movies. I like movies. You like boys. I like boys. And so they just cracked up. And somehow that's our byline, whatever. We contact each other. I like pizza, she'll sign it, or I like, whatever. So that's basically how it happened. And I found out over the years, of course, my brothers would staunchly defend me when people would badmouth me in later years in town. But I didn't know any of that.
That's a good support system.
Yeah.
Could you explain a little bit about being LGBT and during the draft and how that stigmatized you, or...
It was awful. Well, first of all, you felt ashamed because you had to do that. You felt like a freak.
You really couldn't serve because if you did go in and got caught, then you would be arrested.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you had to try to prevent yourself from getting in that situation because, mm-hmm. you know, even though if you weren't acting out, somebody could accuse you of being a homosexual and that'd be enough.
Yeah.
So you really had to protect yourself from getting in that situation. A lot of our friends did serve in the military. And some, you know, never were found out and others were. And literally drummed out of
like
the service.
Like Herman.
Right. A friend of Bob's that we met about the same time that we met each other again came to visit us one time here in Eau Claire, a black man, and he was in the military. And somehow they found out about the fact that he was here and they came to investigate. They sent investigators asking questions on whether he was gay.
Right.
And it's like, man, I wouldn't know.
And it was such an awkward feeling because I was trying to defend Herman, but I was also trying to defend myself. I mean, more than humiliation, I don't know how to describe it. You know, like, I'm sitting there defending Herman, but I'm also very, I don't know how to explain it, not offended or frightened, but ashamed of who I am mm-hmm. while I'm talking to them about somebody else. And I'm feeling dreadful that I'm lying. But I have to lie for Herman's sake because God knows what they do to him. It could be jailed, I suppose, in the military.
Or jumped out of the service.
Jumped out of the service or whatever it is. But all while I'm doing this, I say, I'm talking about me too. It was just an awful, awful, awful feeling.
And when they came to investigate, they already knew at that point that you guys...
No.
No.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember the circumstances other than somehow they suspected him.
They had gone through his locker and they had found magazines of naked men.
Okay.
And then he had said, well, he was an artist. And somehow that slipped out in the conversation with them. And so I played on that and said, well, I don't know if he's an artist, but I knew he did a lot of drawing, a lot of sketching. So that was the tale we wove. But but they were suspicious of him, and that's why they went through his locker. And of course, in the military, you don't need any excuse. You can just open anything you want. So I don't, and he doesn't to this day, know why they selected him. Because he outwardly didn't give any indication of, there was no effeminacy, there was none of that.
He was in the wrong place to write.
But there's a lot of witch hunting, well, not even in the military, in neighborhoods. You know, we could have been kicked out of our houses so many times or lost our jobs and just by people accusing us. And how do you defend yourself against something like that? And obviously, it's true. But if it wasn't true, how do you defend yourself against that sort of, you know, attack? And so it was just, we were really, 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 really cautious and led for many years a double life.
Right. Still in the open layout.
Mm-hmm. I am more than certainly than you
sure.
are. That's why you're here.
And Roger, so you're not openly out?
No, I mean, I never deny what I am, but I'm not like in my job as a tour guide. I don't talk about my sexuality. If they ask me, I'm not married. Mm-hmm. I always sort of intimate I'm divorced because that ends the conversation. But it wouldn't be comfortable to with the people that I'm working with in a tour situation of coming out to them. It's a 1 to 2 week period where I don't want to discuss my sexuality, nor theirs, that kind of thing. So I'm not open there. And when I worked at the university, I worked at the university for 30 years, people knew I was gay, but I never flaunted it a couple of times would come to the defense of somebody if I could, who was gay and being punished for it. And I would, you know, fund things when I could, but I never was an openly gay faculty member.
Mm-hmm. What was your coming out experience like?
Much more slowly. I denied it for years, dated constantly. I don't think I really admitted that I was gay until I went for my selective service when I went in the military. That was probably the day that I finally decided that I had to admit to myself that I was gay. Mm-hmm. And so then when he went through Minneapolis because he was in Minnesota. I was living in Wisconsin teaching in Wausau at that time. And I had to go to Milwaukee for my selective service screening. And literally it was one of the most embarrassing moments of my life, where I had to walk around and I had this huge folder. Both sides were stamped with big words of sexual deviant on it. All day long I had to walk through all these men naked with this, you know, it was like you felt like the scarlet letter A on your chest, and but I made it through. But it was one, I think that probably was the day that I decided I had to admit what it was. But and then luckily I met him, and if we wouldn't have become a couple, there are a lot of gay people who sort of disappeared because they went away. Sometimes they got it through alcohol and some through suicide. But when you got a friend, it helps a lot.
Have you experienced a lot of just stigma, especially after like labeling yourself as like quote unquote sexual deviant through like the draft and stuff? Did you guys like feel a lot of stigma like after
there,
that?
There are times in your career, in education, you know, you couldn't be open, and there are promotions probably that weren't given because of that.
Well, you know one for sure, that Larry Schnack.
Yeah.
They're trying to use us against your
right. When I was a director of admissions at the university, and I was moving into that position, my supervisor wanted to make me director of high school relations because he didn't want me to be the director of admissions. And the chancellor came to my defense and said, no, this isn't going to work that way, and got my promotion that way because he was, you know, totally comfortable with it. He wasn't. So there were times like that. You know, you felt the stigma.
Right.
It doesn't go away. I mean, even at our age now, you'll get situations where you're suddenly different.
Are there any other examples, like, now that you have, like, felt stigmatized? And...
Well, I think you reach a certain age when you don't give a fuck.
Yeah, that's it. I think that's it.
Yeah.
And, you know, look it's around. Their problem. I said, we've been together 46 years, and you've been married twice. Or, you know, whatever the case may be. I think... But things have changed a lot, too. I mean, we are probably one of the more prominent gay couples in town because civically we're involved in a lot. And it's always as Bob and Roger. You know, every function we go to is Bob and Roger. Everything we give to is Bob and Roger. Like, we're going to a big social function tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. And it's Bob and Roger's. And, I mean, this has happened gradually over the years. And even in the early years, it was always Bob and Roger, but nobody talked about it. Neither did we. But things have gotten to a point where it's talked about now. Not a lot, at least to our faces.
It's different. I mean,
it's, you know, it's so different.
Kids come out in high school. And
well, one of the biggest things is our boy Lee, you know, who was a student and is a son now, who was gay. When we wrongly brought him into our lives, we said, you can't do this, you know. Because he was just open to his friends and people, and we were scared for him.
Yeah,
because I had my nose broken years ago because I was a faggot. And, you know, we were used to that sort of intimidation, which I'm sure still exists to a certain extent. But we learned a lot through Lee and his openness, and he went back to school, and he was talking about us as Bob and Roger and his dads. And first of all, everybody knew, but it was unspoken. Mm-hmm. You know, it was never spoken. And the closest to really admitting I was gay was when we got Lee, because he's a student at our school and he was openly gay, and, you know, he was in foster care, and he came into our lives. Well, that definitely then, you know.
Right.
But my good friends always do, as we have found out since, and my students always knew, because I'm friends with a lot of my former students, and I said, well, what did you kids talk about? And he said, well, we never talked about it. It was always Mr. Carr and Roger. I mean, that's just the way kids are. We never talked about it. It was always Mr. Carr and Roger.
And this whole thing has happened over the last four decades, went from being very closeted and very frightening to now it's no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And like even in this neighborhood, this is a really nice neighborhood of Eau Claire. When we moved in the 70s, or late 70s, bought this house, you know, I was a little conscious of the fact we were gay and we might be shunned by the neighbors and stuff like that. We've outlived everybody now.
Yeah. So in those days, we were just the bachelors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We
move,
bachelors.
You know, when people move in now and there's a gay couple across the street. Oh, okay. No big deal.
Right.
You know, we don't chase our children or anything. But it was that kind of attitude back in the 70s.
But I think, it's to our credit, because the way we lived our lives, that we set a very positive example in many respects. Mm-hmm. That we did not fit the stereotype of the gay people, bar people, drag people, protesting people, that we were just regular people who went to work and helped out in the neighborhood, you know, and we just happened to be gay. Mm-hmm. And I think in that respect that we've done some good, you know, just being regular people. Right. You know, the gayness has never really run our life. It's just what we are. It's not, we've never been on a mission about it.
How have you seen the LGBT community change from when you guys first moved in here to Eau Claire to now? I know you subtly mentioned things, but overall.
The bar scene, when I was a bartender, it was very secretive. People would come in and they'd come in by the back door and they would be afraid to leave, you know, and it was that kind of, and now, you know, gay bars, people, everybody goes to the gay bars. It's the best place to dance in Eau Claire.
Straight people go there too.
Yeah, it's like, that's definitely changed. There was no, we had a very small community of people. We get together and, you know, like have potlucks on Sunday nights together and stuff like that, but it wasn't a very large group. But now they have huge picnics out on the river for gay week or whatever, and they have fundraising and things that happen that are very open. They have drag shows at the bar that, you know.
And at our theater, the community theater.
Yeah, community
we started at the community theater 30-some years ago. That's still going very strong. And the Queens of the Valley, for 3 years now, have done a benefit for us and pack them in. But the nice thing is being in theater, it's not the type of show you'd see at the bar. They're well rehearsed. I mean, it's classy. Mm-hmm. And so people walk in, and that myth is kind of disappeared because they're seeing is a real show, not just a bunch of guys walking around in high heels and wigs. I mean, some of them are just really, really, really talented, and they sing and they dance and they be lovely. That's something else that has changed. There's a drag queen in town called D Lovely. And
have you run across him yet?
Actually, it was mentioned earlier today, so mm-hmm. I would love to hear
you
more.
Should.
Yeah.
And
you shouldn't.
You should.
Oh, I think you should. Shouldn't.
Roger doesn't know this, but one time he was talking to me about his growing up and his father not accepting and being very, very cruel, his mother being supportive. And I just said offhand, I said, I would be so proud to have you as my son. And so that's why he calls me Daddy. Because last time we saw him, he goes, oh, Daddy. And Roger's looking at me, have I become a sugar daddy? but you know, and it's been wonderful watching his transition from a dizzy drag queen into a man of depth. His self-esteem has risen so much that he's become a real activist in town, mm-hmm. as D. Lovely. Mm-hmm. I mean, he
goes into schools.
He goes into it. Depending on the situation, he'll go in drag or he'll not go in drag. But it's always as D Lovely, female impersonator, and it's very fun for me being a teacher and liking that is watching his self-esteem, watching him discover that he's more than D Lovely, the drag queen. That he's, as I said, D. I said I envision one day that, because he spells it D E E Lovely. I said, I envision one day that I'm just going to see a capital D period Lovely, because that's how he's grown. Yeah, you have to.
And he's a good example of what has changed in the valley, because he couldn't have existed in the 80s even.
No.
They would have drummed him out of town.
No.
But he lives very openly and very proud of what he is. And
he's respected in the community.
Yeah. He can't
for what he's doing.
He can't sew, so he hasn't got the best outfits in the world, but...
Thank God he has friends who can sew. But yeah, yeah, you really must talk to him.
With the, trans or the drag queen community, mm-hmm. How has that changed throughout the time?
I don't remember anybody being in drag... Well, a couple times at the bar back in the 70s, I suppose.
But that'd be Halloween or something.
Yeah, people would come in, but it'd be as a joke drag. It would never be a... But then because we're so close to Minneapolis, St. Paul, anybody who wanted to, we'd go up there. And so we used to go to drag shows in Minneapolis when we were kids, just because it was something to do and something to see. And I think that's probably where the people went who were of that, you know, who were transgender. It would be easier for them to go to the big city. They wouldn't stay around here. I don't remember anybody being transgender in those years. I'm sure they just left.
Yeah.
Are you aware of anybody who's transgender now?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. We have the woman who's the, well, we have, what, is she transgender now?
She's a woman.
Yeah.
She's a woman.
She was a man. She's now a woman.
Was a very prominent...
insurance person.
Insurance person. Very prominent insurance person. And that, boy, got to give him her credit.
I mean, is that somebody you're going to interview?
Emery.
No, oh, Emery, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. All right. So you know the story. Yeah. But talk about...
Actually, you could elaborate on the story.
Well, I mean, just... we had heard about it. I mean, we knew... who he was when he was a
he. I knew him as a man. He was a mason, big in the Masonic temple.
And real leader in the community.
Yeah, the community, sort of a bigwig. And then he just sort of disappeared.
And we had heard that he had announced, he went to his high school reunion and announced to all of his classmates that at the next reunion I will be, I don't know if he had selected his name yet or not, went to the Masons and said, I'm resigning because of this, and told all of his clients. Well, we didn't know him at the time. We knew who he was. And we were at a political rally a couple of years ago with some friends, and there were these two beautiful blonde women there, and I said, well, who are they? I said, what beautiful women. I said, are they gay? You know, are they lesbian? And Chris said, you're looking at the most realistic transgender person I ever met in my life. And we met her that night, and gradually, and then we went to hear her and Jane speak
at the LGBT center. Community center, yeah.
And I mean, that was just so powerful.
That was revealing for me, because I've been so closeted my whole life. I can't imagine changing my gender.
And to this day, I guess I understand that. I don't understand drag very much. But it was just, I'm thinking, first of all, you're gorgeous. And you're together, and you're bright, you know, and you know what you're doing, and you're articulate, and she was explaining what she went through, and I thought, holy moly. I mean, I'd read about that, but I never heard somebody talk about that. I mean, by that, I mean that struggle, which is hard for me to comprehend.
What was the name of the one? Christine Jorgensen.
Yeah.
When we were kids, there was a woman named Christine Jorgensen who had a sex change in Denmark.
Okay.
And I remember hearing about that and getting that strange feeling, because I didn't understand. I knew I was different, but I didn't know I wasn't that. Mm-hmm. But I remember hearing that story and sitting, getting kind of uncomfortable with it. And I don't think I ever really met somebody who was a total sex change. I met people who were going through it, but Anne Marie is just, you know, she they painted our room.
Our rooms?
Yeah, they paint.
And it was just, it's really neat, because in a conversation, somebody said, Jane, you know, how do you feel about this? And Jane said, well, you know, after a period of time, sex is not really that important in a relationship. It's love. Mm-hmm. And we love each other. And so to me, it's just fine. I love Anne Marie. And to watch them together, I mean, it's just adorable, because there is so much love there. And I'm going, this isn't right. I don't understand this. Two beautiful blondes.
Anne Marie's kids have got some problems.
Oh, yeah, the kids.
Her son is not a doctor.
Not handled it well.
No, he still hasn't. This isn't the way he wanted his world to be.
Right.
But Anne Marie would encounter her former friend or her friends when she was a man at a post office or something, and they would get really comfortable and say, oh, Sam, it's just me in a wig. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm still the same person. And if you're not comfortable, that's okay. And you don't have to talk to me anymore. But I just want you to know I'm the same person. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way she is. She's just not forceful, but just very matter of fact, this is. And if you're not comfortable with it, I will respect that. But I'm still the same person.
And then who's the one who's the writer? The one that you've had in the author? She teaches at the Children's Theater? No, at the Community Theater? The woman from Fall Creek who's got the bad...
Oh.
I don't remember her name. But she's a transgender and she's had a sex change, right? Yeah. But she's, you know, so many men have an Adam's apple, and she's kind of looks like a man.
She's a child's author and
a brilliant teacher.
Our theater hires her to teach during the summer, and God, she's magic with kids. Just magic with kids.
I can't remember her name.
It was really neat. She was called me and went, come here, I want to show you something. She's all teary. And we go into the big room, and there are all of her kids working, writing in silence, but they're all working so hard, and she's got tears. Isn't that the most beautiful thing you've ever seen? And I go, yes. I mean, it was. It was just...
But back to what your question is, there are probably more transgender people in the community that I don't know.
There's a college kid who was called Wonder Woman, who was very open and had a sex change, had been through the whole thing while he was a student and ran for homecoming queen. Remember, we saw him in a float dressed as Wonder Woman?
Yeah.
And seems that it was no big deal. I mean, for us, you know, it means no big deal to you either because you're of a different generation. But for us to see that, mm-hmm. you know, sitting in a, and everybody's cheering him on in the float, her on in the float, you know, things have changed so fast and so much.
It hasn't been fast.
Well, it seems like it.
Yeah.
I mean, for so long, it was so hidden and so scary and frightening and, you know, to be found out and then just to see how. And don't get me wrong, they still have difficulties, they have lots of difficulties, but boy, it's much easier for them.
They're more role models.
Yes.
I mean, I'm just turning on the television and seeing a gay person, when if I would have had that at 16,
yeah.
it would have been so much easier, because I didn't know what I was, and you don't want to admit what you are, and there was nobody out there that could explain it to you. And you know, sex education, we were talking about that the other day. My sex education was finding a booklet my mother got when she was probably a newlywed, and she had thrown it away, and I found it, and I read it all. It's the first time I ever really knew what was going on, because nobody talked about it. It was like, and I lived on a farm, so I understood what sex was, but I didn't know sexuality until I read that little booklet. And then I got caught with it, because I shared it with a neighbor girl, and she, her mother, found it, and I got in trouble. And that was the strangest way to learn sexuality. But there was nothing in school. You never discussed, never in church. Mm-hmm. It was just never. Even parents, most parents just didn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. Who were we just talking to? Maybe it was on my tour. Anyway, talking a mother. Her mother gave her a bag of stuff and said, "Eventually, you're going to need to use this."
No, that's somebody we know.
Yeah, that was her introduction to being a female. Her mother gave her a box with tampons and something and said, "You're going to need to know how to use this sometime." And didn't explain what it was.
Somebody's daughter came to her and said, "I think I'm going to need a training bra." And she got this information through Pleasant Dolls or something. Who was it?
Yeah. Well, I can't.
But anyway.
She found a really good book through the Pleasant Company, you know, those American Girl dolls. Mm-hmm. She has a great book out now on how to explain it to your children.
I wish I had that, but I was a kid.
Yeah, because her mother had given her a box and said, "You're going to need this eventually."
Yeah.
Yeah, and then that was part of it. You know, there was no place to go. There was no place to read. There were no gay characters in novels.
Mm-hmm. If they were, it was always bad.
Yeah, and so there was nothing out there to... So that's so different now. People can just... And if parents discover that their child might be gay, there are resources. So like, we have a friend who's adopted a boy from Russia, and Pete is probably going to be gay someday. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But they've gone to all kinds of gender people to talk about it, and it's amazing what's out there for people now. And that wasn't there.
How do you feel like it's changed within the school systems? Just being the awareness of the LGBT?
Well, I know at the university, there used to be a lot of persecution of the people who were gay in the residence halls because, you know, they were just punished for being there, sort of. But then they sort of banded together with their little organization. And when that first started at the university, that sort of changed the whole thing because they got together and they talked about it. So that sort of collegial kind of thing really helped the people at the university. At the high school level, it worked that way too.
But I think that you have to go individually. You can't say generally high schools. It depends on the faculty, the community, the students. Lee, our son, did a lot for me as far as opening my eyes, and they wanted to start an LGBT program and came to me and asked if I would be the faculty thing, and I got all uptight and said no, I wouldn't be comfortable with that. And then one of my best friends at school, who is a mother of a child and, you know, is not obviously gay, said she would do it. And then I thought for a while, I thought, well, what's this? Everybody knows Lee is in our life. Who am I trying to kid? You know, I've worked here 33 years and I've been with Roger all of those years and everybody knows. So we became the faculty people, and the reaction to the school was nothing. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of straight kids also who would come to the meetings and the discussions. It was never much talked about in the lounge any more than any other club was. Mm-hmm. But that was that school. There was another school, what, Altoona?
Some of the schools around here had problems starting to get organized because the faculty
or administration won't allow it to happen. So it depends on that school community, I think.
But I think the organization in Eau Claire now, that's the LGBTQ, whatever it is, doesn't really have a focus right now. It's sort of gotten lame. The person who was sort of the person behind it just recently died, and he was the one who kept it going for a long time, and I think that helped a lot of the people who needed a place to go. We never really went there except for a couple of lectures and
a couple of times on legal things that they were having some kind of speaker that we wanted to hear about the legality of it all. Mm-hmm. And but there were people who went there. They had a library and they had, you know. But now that's sort of fallen apart.
Yeah.
Is this a specific community center?
Yeah.
I'm with Chris Ione.
Yeah.
He was, oh God, I love that boy.
So could you expand a little bit on the community center here? And obviously you're saying it kind of fell apart.
Yeah.
What was the process?
I don't know. We never really were that involved. We donated a couple times, and you remember.
Oh, yeah, we remember. But only through Chris that we know. And it's... there was no focus, and there was no real leader, and Chris was that. And when he went off the board, they just kind of went off in other directions and did make wise decisions.
And yeah, they moved from the church where they had a space, and the church wanted them to move. They needed the space for something else, and they bought or rented something they couldn't afford, and then they sort of went under because they didn't have the money.
So they made bad financial decisions.
So now it's it's an email system now. I don't think there's anything. And they do something socially, but I don't think there's any real center anymore. I think if there is, it's not well publicized.
What kind of events do they usually do? Are you aware of?
They had the picnics out on the river. Again, Chris and his partner used to do a lot of that stuff. They've had some potlucks, I think. I've never really... Bob gets upset sometimes. I don't really enjoy hanging around gay people. I have all my straight friends, and some of them are gay. But going to an all-gay thing is kind of a...
That's not right. You don't like going things just because they're gay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, just because you're gay doesn't mean I'm going to be your friend. It's not... You made it sound worse than it is.
Yeah.
It's not like that at all.
So we haven't done a lot with the center other than support it when we could through Chris.
Financially, we supported it.
Yeah.
But, you know, at our age, what for?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see the center hopefully be for the younger people struggling, trying to find identity, looking for help, looking for ideas. I mean, looking for mentors, we'd certainly do that. But after Chris left, it didn't really have a reason to exist anymore. And it just kind of...
It may start up again.
Yeah.
I mean, the community's big enough here where they could. They just need somebody who can pull it all together and you belong to organizations, you know, you have some people who are just sort of, they can't put it together. They just belong, and that was what was going on there for a while.
Yeah.
But.
What other, like, protests or, I know they have Pride here. Have mm-hmm. you guys participated in Pride at all?
Have you? I never.
Once, with Lee. It's an age thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many people our age do you see go out on parades and, you know, maybe if we're younger, but no. Although we've gone to the cities. Yeah, I would feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, we went once, and we were at the Guthrie one time, and we went across the street to Loring Park, and they had a big gay thing going on.
Gay pride thing.
And so we walked around there, and it was interesting. And then once when we were in Japan visiting Lee, we happened to be there on Gay Pride or something like that, and there was a parade, and we watched, and it was like, you're not really part of it, but yet you are part of it. But I wouldn't seek it out. So that's why I really can't tell you much about the organization here.
Yeah. With Lee, was he very active in the community here?
He started out to be. Remember, he's out there doing their computer stuff. We got him to the youth meetings they had, and that helped him a lot because that just helped him a lot. And then when he graduated, he did a lot of their whatever they needed computer things, but then he got busy with college.
You know, life.
But it certainly, for the time he was there, was valuable for him.
Yeah.
It was helpful for him.
You said you were foster parents to Lee primarily. Mm-hmm. Could you expand on that process and how that?
Sure, tell me the story.
The whole thing?
Well, I was kicked out of his family.
He was an orphan. His father was killed in a car accident when he was 3, and his mother committed suicide when he was 9. And it appears staged it so he would discover her when he got home from school. And the little bit of family he did have tried to take him in, but he was so incorrigible, it was ruining their families. So they put him in foster care. And he had been in, 9 homes in 7 years before he came to Fall Creek. He was down in the La Crosse area. And there was something legal going on there with the police. He'd gotten in some sort of trouble that we chose not to find out about, so I don't know what it was. But he was sent up here in Fall Creek, which is a small school. And I've always, because it is a small school and it's very cliquish, whenever we have had new students, I always seek them out and try to make them feel comfortable, you know, those first few days. And I had gotten some computer equipment to make movies and stuff, and he was really with computers, so I stopped him in the hallway and said, well, I understand you can do this, and I've got all of this equipment, and I don't know how to run it, I don't know how to learn to do it, and I don't want to. Would you figure it out for me? And so he would come in during his study hall, which was my prep, and that's how we became friends. And and then I put him in a show because I felt he needed to be in a show to meet people. And for 20 or 30 years over Thanksgiving, we always go to New Mexico. And I always schedule rehearsals with somebody else over that holiday, knowing that they're not going to take place. But I do it anyway. Mm-hmm. And so the typical thing happened. They showed 1 or 2, nothing happened. Lee takes things very seriously, just panicking. And so, because they heard about my temper. He'd never seen it, but he heard about my temper, which is logic. And anyway, so we get back from vacation, and he came, and he's apologizing. Don't get mad, Mrs. Carr, but we tried to have a rehearsal, and this went on, and I tried to call you at home, and the phone answered, and the woman who answered said that you and your person were out of town, so I couldn't get a hold of you to find out what was going on. That's okay. A couple hours later, he's in the auditorium setting lights, and he comes in, and he's really nervous. And he said, can I talk to you, Mr. Carr? And I said, sure. And he said, long, he was stammering. He's real tall. He's really gawky. And he said, I think I'm like you. And not picking up. And he goes, oh, you should be so lucky. And he did. No, he says, like you inside. And so he came out to me, and we talked for a long time there, and the relationship obviously changed, and he would come and talk to me a lot, and we became good friends. Then I introduced him to Raj, and we would do some things together, but you know, you have to be very careful. And he was staying with a good Christian family. Mm-hmm. And I came to work one morning here, all four of them was crumpled up in front of my door. And he looks up, and his face is white, and his eyes are red, and he'd been crying. And it turned out that his good Christian family found out he was gay and didn't want him anymore, and gave him 2 weeks to get out. And so all the social workers were involved, and we tried to click into getting him. Long story short, they were going to place him in Mondovi. They're trying to find foster care, and to my faculty, my colleagues' credit, over half a dozen called his social worker and said he cannot leave this district. We do not want him to leave this district. So they found a woman to take him, who was kind of a friend.
We tried to become foster parents, but it's really hard to do it fast. You can't do it in 2 weeks. And we got approval finally, but it was well after the fact. In the meantime, they found a woman who had always taken women only, girls only, but she was willing to take Lee because he was sort of a girl. And he lived with her for the last year and a half of high school.
The last year.
Last year.
Yeah, with high school, and then came in.
Then he moved here.
But by that time, we had become a family, or, you know, do lots of stuff together, and then, of course, all through school.
Wow.
He went to the university here and lived lived on campus the whole time, but you know, we were still so close.
And it wasn't long for me to learn that just because I was a teacher who worked really well with students does not make you a good parent. It has nothing to do with parenting. And yeah, it was just a really unique experience because here you have this kid moving into the house with two old men who'd been together forever, and then you have two old men who are used to being in our chairs doing what we do, having a kid around the house. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a transition for all of us, but it's
worked out well.
It worked out well, and now we are a family, and we love each other a lot. You know, and he refers to us as his dads. And we go to Japan, and he introduces us. These are my dads, mm-hmm. which is a little hard for them to comprehend. Two dads. But.
There are no gay people in Japan, though.
Yeah, according to the Japanese,
they don't acknowledge it.
It's a Japanese thing.
So it can be open because they're gay people.
Yeah, it's a strange society.
That is interesting. How do you see Lee's process or him as a gay man? Different. How does it differ from your growing up and being gay men?
I think he admitted he was gay when he was probably six. And that's part of the reason his family couldn't take care of him, I think. I don't think he was ever not gay.
And he's not effeminate or anything, it's just that he's a gay man.
Yeah. He's actually 6'6", Bob, not 6'4".
Oh,
he's very tall. He doesn't play basketball.
I'm sure he gets that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. But he, he's very talented. He's a musician. He was in Statesman here, which is the men's choir, and he traveled in Europe several times. I don't think it's ever been a problem for him because...
I don't know where that is, but...
No.
Yeah, no.
He just totally accepts himself. I'm sure he's had, some problems too. When he was talking to you, there was no one to talk to, and then eventually you find somebody to talk to. But I think he basically, is very happy with his sexuality. I don't think he would change it.
No.
That's always a good question to ask people. And I was a counselor, and I'd be real careful too because I didn't want my counselees to know anything about my sexuality because it would change the way we had dynamics. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the things that is a real down-to-earth question with people. Would you change if you could? Because
that sort of changes the whole dynamics of where you're heading.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Lee would ever be very content.
Good.
Yeah. And we help it, I think.
Yeah, and he's been very appreciative. He mentions nice things.
It helped him going to a small school, too. I don't know what kind of high schools you went to, but sometimes small schools, it depends. Some small schools probably are more intolerant, but some schools are very tolerant.
Mm-hmm.
And some large high schools, you can find your niche because there's other people around like you. But Fall Creek was a perfect school for him.
To be honest, I think I had a lot to do with it being gay.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very prominent in school, and I was one of the leaders.
I don't think you're the only person leader in that
school. No, I know I'm not doing it, but I was obviously the most obvious because of you coming to all the things whenever, because I'm dyslexic, I can't travel. I can't drive in big places so whenever I'd have to take a group of kids to a city, Roger would come along and be the chauffeur, and it was just a given that we,
Right.
So it was just kind of in the Fall Creek community that we were, I think.
I know you mentioned Lee started the LGBT, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
In, was it your high school?
Yeah.
Okay. You said that you felt like, at first you just didn't want to have a part of that. Why do you feel like you had that at first?
I'm old.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's a whole different generation, and I was still kind of hiding, I guess. And to do that would just be to confirm what everybody knew. I don't know.
No,
I don't know. I have no idea.
I can't imagine. If they'd have asked me to be the advisor for the college one, I would have said no to it. Yeah. You know, I'm sorry.
I don't know. I can't explain.
It's legitimate.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about it now that it was past tense, and I still don't know why. I don't know why.
And is that group still thriving today?
That I don't know.
Okay.
Because I've not kept in contact with the school.
Okay. How long have you been retired?
7 years.
Mm-hmm. And you as well, Roger?
I've been retired for
longer. Much.
12.
Yeah.
12 years, yeah.
So how did you guys feel like any stigma, like being in the school system, like from how many years were both of you involved in the school systems?
I taught 3 years in high school and 30 at the university. And other than sometimes the chance of moving up or changing jobs within the system, I think there was some problems because people knowing I was, or suspected I was gay, I probably wasn't considered as a viable candidate. But other than that, I think it was pretty easy. Mm-hmm. In an educated setting, most people are not stigmatized. It's like once in a while you'll find somebody who's a bigot, you know, and
yeah.
You know, but they're any place. In high school, it's a little bit different.
I was like 34 years. I would, at one time or two times, there was a movement afoot to try to get rid of me because I was gay. That's those Jim Kling years that I knew nothing about until it was over, and the administrator called me and said, "I think you should know this happened," and would explain it to me. And he said, "But as long as I'm administrator, you don't have to worry about anything."
Oh, that's good.
And he said, "The reason I didn't tell you why this is going on is because I didn't want you to stew. I just wanted you to go on working and doing what you're doing. And it's over, it's taken care of. As long as I'm here, nothing will ever happen." So, but that happened twice.
Your parent came in and tried to.
Parents.
Yeah.
That's a shame. How do you feel like the curriculum has changed since, like, you guys went to school and, you know, teaching in the high school and, like, being even in college?
Yeah.
How do you feel like that's changed through time?
Well, in the high school, it just slips in. Mm. I don't think there's... In the small high school, I don't know about large high school, in my high school, it had a lot to do with the teacher and their beliefs, and it would just... be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't any considered effort that we were going to include and talk about gay writers or gay scientists or gay people in history, depending on whoever the gay mathematician, whoever the teacher was, would just bring it in. It wasn't a curricular thing, and it was not terribly common, but it wasn't uncommon.
Right.
So it wasn't part of the curriculum, but it was part of the education.
At the university level, I think over class, you know, younger faculty came in and added to classes selection and stuff like that. And I think, like in English, there were some of the classes that studied gay authors. It wasn't really a big deal. And I think now it's like there are more role models in the university. The dean of students is gay. The current director of admissions that replaced me, not immediately, but she's gay. And so it's like, there are all kinds of gay people there that are
openly gay,
but are part of the university. And that's different in the university than in high school. In high school, it's still not openly gay people. The curriculum is probably a little more tolerant, but the people are still more closeted in the high school.
And you almost have to be, you know, with the all the born-agains, the religious stuff, God, you know, battling. If it isn't that, it's one thing or another, and it's much more difficult in a high school as it is in higher education.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I think like the residence halls here, I don't know what they're like in Madison, but topics are just brought forward. I mean, they're going to talk about them. They bring them there, and whether you want to hear them or not, they're on the docket. They'll talk about it, so you're going to get an education whether you want to or not.
Right. Mm-hmm. And just going off from what you guys said, that probably wouldn't have even been a question when you guys were in school.
No. No,
I remember one time a friend said, talking about fairies, and they said, "You're a fairy, Bob, but you're a good fairy." And see, I don't, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you never know who you are. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. I never knew how I appeared to others, and they would make comments like that, and I didn't know what they were talking about.
Well, you weren't out.
Well, I guess I wasn't aware that I was effeminate or fairy, or I mean, I don't know what they were basing that on.
I remember, I brought back a memory, because I knew I was different, I didn't want to be different, and I had to ride the school bus for 40 minutes every morning and evening. And I remember that you had to be careful not to wear a certain color on a certain day, or it was a fairy color. So I just live in panic that I'd forget and wear that color and then be called a fairy. And one time I tied my scarf the wrong way and got beat up on the bus because I was wearing a scarf like a fairy. So there's a, you know, little instance like that that, you know, you sort of block. But there were times
when you knew you were different and you didn't know why, mm-hmm. but you were.
Are there like any like specific incidents besides like that one? And I know you mentioned getting your nose broken, Bob. Just
Pete's Fifth Avenue should hang out in bars.
Where you guys have been, like, you know, just tormented.
Well, we've had, well, not in years.
No.
But you just get late night threatening calls or obscene calls or derogatory calls. Our car's egged. People stopping by and saying,
you know. Back to your incident he was at a bar with a hairdresser, a very gay man, and somebody took a swing at the hairdresser, and the hairdresser ducked.
And I got it, went sailing across the room.
So it was, you were just the wrong place.
Yeah. But it was still a gay crime.
Yeah.
The one who was intended for ducked, and I got it. Yeah. But it was because we were gay, or he was.
We should hang on to Pete's Fifth Avenue.
Well, thank God.
I don't think I've ever felt threatened.
Oh, we've been on trips. Remember when we the first time went to China? I never told you this. But that couple from up there, he was a heavier guy, Paul, he took all those pictures. Hmm. Anyway, I was farther back, and you decided to sit in the front with him. Remember how we were changing the front seat? And he came back, and people were saying something. He said, "Oh, yeah, yeah, but my wife doesn't want me up there because she's afraid I won't keep my hands to myself." And they all laughed and stuff like that.
No.
And I never told you that because I didn't want you to be hurt. But it's so long ago now; it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, the little thing that, you know, that happens to everybody. It's just.
Well, it was because you were gay. Because we were gay.
Yeah.
And, you know, in his defense, if there is any, you know, we don't travel incognito anymore. We travel as a couple, you know. We never did. We always did everything together. But when you're younger, they excuse that, I think. I don't know.
Going off of that.
Actually, can we pause for a second?
Sure.
I just need to go to the bathroom.